You're listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise with Justin Hopper.
If we succeed in making robots, what we really mean by robots, which is sort of artificially intelligent, corporeal kind of artificially built things, then it'll be the first time we've made something that can actually reflect on the nature of its own origins. And there's a certain, I think, obligation to provide an origin story that's something that those future robots can feel good about. Robots were going to be war machines, and that's exactly what they're going to be, and no more. And so making this effort to give them a different kind of genesis, a different origin story that's more rooted in play and a love for the natural environment and an interest in the environment was part of what I was and am trying to achieve.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features an interview with a contemporary landscape practitioner, nature writers and post-natural scientists, architects and archaeologists, artists, musicians, and activists interested in the strange ways we today experience our surroundings. I'm your host, Justin Hopper, and you've just heard today's guest, artist and roboticist Ian Ingram, discussing his unique work, which attempts to connect robots with the natural world. More from Ian very soon. The music you hear is the title track from When the Sun Came by Nick Jonah Davis. It's been a while since I've connected with you from my little studio in the Uncanny Vale, a quiet corner here in eastern England. I'm sorry to be so out of touch. Life does get in the way, doesn't it? And oh my, has there been a lot of life lately. Over the coming weeks and months, I'll bring you some new conversations, as well as some rather old ones that you've never heard. This is one of them. I spoke to Ian Ingram not too far off a year ago, at the tail end of a residency at the Ardis Zoo in Amsterdam, which he'll discuss several times. Ian is an artist and roboticist based in California, whose work has, for more than 20 years, revolved around a key theme: building robots that attempt to communicate with animals in their own language. Ian's work combines his training as a roboticist with an understanding of animal behavior and morphology, as well as the history of sculpture and a great sense of humor, to make machines that signal, wave, and speak in the kinetic language that specific animals might understand, and sometimes in symbolic ways that they won't get, but maybe we will. Ian has been one of my favorite artists for many years, and I'd like to thank him not only for this joyful conversation, but for his patience in waiting for this podcast to be published. And I'd also like to thank you for listening. Now that I'm starting to make some episodes again, I hope you'll share them with a like-minded friend. And if you enjoy these kinds of conversations, sign up for the free Uncanny Landscapes newsletter at uncannylandscapes.substack.com for a first shot at the podcasts and lots of other thoughts. And now, without further ado, Ian Ingram.
Yeah, so, you know, In a nutshell, I make robots that try to communicate with animals. I do a lot of other sorts of things in that domain, but that's a project I've been working on for, you know, basically a couple decades now. And that has involved lizards and doing push-up robots and see the territorial push-ups of the lizards and then respond, and lizards that look for predators of squirrels, and then squirrels use the squirrel's own tail flick alarm signal to try to warn the squirrels that there's predators around. And there's a whole set of issues surrounding those projects that are more than just what they do. But and that also includes Nevermore-O-Matic, which is telling stories about the end of the world, human stories, but wrapped up in a machine code, which is Morse code, but then rendered into beak wipes, which is a kind of signal for birds. So it's sort of a bunch of things all on top of one another in such a way that it becomes a little bit obscure for all the the animals, including the humans who might be watching it. But in a way that takes a little bit of explaining, because it's wiping its beak all the time, for animals that have a theory of mind, which ravens and crows and magpies and other corvids do have, it theoretically creates a sort of aura of anxiety wherever it's doing this thing. an artist I've been working on since about 2017, this project called Pigeon Smidgen, which is a little bit of a deviation from the robots that are really trying hard to communicate with the animals and seeing if they can pull that off, which have met with some success, at least anecdotally, they've met with some success. In this case, it does the mating dance of the rock pigeon, the common pigeon, the worldwide synanthropic animal that we see sort of everywhere. And it does it with, you know, the highest fidelity that I can achieve, but it's using a part of the pigeon that pigeons don't even know about, which is the male reproductive organs. So it's kind of the right moves with the wrong parts is what it comes down to. So there isn't enough, it hasn't spent enough time with pigeons to really give me a sense of whether they're getting it or not, you know, whether the motion is still enough. With the lizard work, the motion was enough. And that's part of what's interesting about it. The objects themselves are rendered down to sort of the bare minimum to do the push-up, but the lizards seem to get the image, get the information nonetheless. But the pigeons, I don't know if the motion is enough, because there's other things the pigeons are doing, you know, they're flaring their feathers and things like that. So we'll see. But in this project, at least in the original conception of this project, I wanted to work with the Victoria Crown pigeons, which are a much larger pigeon species that the artist zoo keeps. And they have a crown, which, you know, makes them kind of royal pigeons. And they live in one of the aviaries with all these tropical plants around and other pigeons, Nicobar pigeons and things like that. And my idea was to create a sort of Cinderella story where I allow a common pigeon, Cinderella, to link up with one of these princely pigeons. So I have a camera there that is watching, and you know, eventually I'll try to actually have it ascertain things about the behavior of the Victoria Crown pigeons, but it hasn't been there very long, so there's not enough time for that. But right now it just looks around and tries to find them, and when it sees them, it sends a signal to the robot pigeon Smidgen, which is sitting in a courtyard with nearby with all the regular pigeons, and then it does the mating dance. Pigeon Smidgen is the robot that sits out in the courtyard, sits out in places where common pigeons are. There's actually in the aviary just a camera. So I've been doing a lot of work with surveillance cameras as part of projects I've been doing with rats over the last few years for an exhibition I had at the Beale Center for Art and Technology in Irvine, California. I was collaborating with this neuroscientist who studies rats, Steve Mahler. And he studies rats, he uses rats in his research, and he keeps them as pets, and he has a rat tattooed on his leg. I mean, he's deeply deeply enveloped in ratness. And I got a lot of time to spend with his rats in his garage in this elaborate cage that he has there. You know, let them out and they'll wander around in the garage, and I would turn off the lights and kind of try to participate in their umwelt of darkness, because they're not very good at seeing. And you can see their whiskers against the backlight coming through the cracks in the garage. And you can really kind of feel what it's like to be them. And so I made these projects that were more about synanthropic animals, the kinds of animals that exist in our spaces that really thrive with us, rats and pigeons and cockroaches and geese and ducks and things. And of course, pigeons are often called rats with wings. So I very quickly got into tying the pigeons, midgen stuff back into the rat stuff. And it all ended up also aligning with these investigations of surveillance cameras. There's this thing, which is, I don't think entirely true. Maybe in some places it's true, where they say if you're in New York City or another big city, you're never more than 6 feet away from a rat. And increasingly, that's true of surveillance cameras. So they're kind of like an analog to the rats. And sort of superficially, but interestingly, they're also black and white, like the kinds of rats that I was working with, which are these Long Evans research rats, a particular strain of Norway rats that a lot of people use for their research. So I was making these objects out of surveillance cameras that essentially wanted nothing more than to sense a rat. So I had one called Sleeping Beauty, which was two surveillance cameras put together, lying on the ground. It's all night, it's watching for rats, and then recording its experiences when it tracks, because these are pan, tilt, zoom surveillance cameras. So they can pan, they can tilt, and they can zoom. And so you can see them doing this. You can even see the zoom because the camera descends into the blackness of the eye. And then also superficially, the black dome of these things is very like the black eyes of the rats. So Sleeping Beauty, this robot made out of two surveillance cameras that have been just attached together and laid on the floor. It watches for the rats, and when it sees them, it gets excited. And then it remembers that experience, kind of episodic memory, if you will. And then during the day, it plays back like REM sleep, rapid eye motion, you know, all the cameras moving around, remembering what it was like when it saw the rats. So this is all to say that the camera that's in the aviary, the one that's in the place where the Victoria Crown Pigeon is another one of these cameras. And so it's hard to, you know, I think a lot about what defines a robot and, you know, where the boundaries of a robot can be. And oftentimes I'm trying with my objects to kind of have all of what is in one thing. So the body is entirely embodied the way we are, you know, we're increasingly sort of spread out, but our core body is in one place. And that's a big part of what it's like to be an animal, to have everything tied into your actual self, your actual sensorium. So in this case, it's, you know, there's the surveillance camera, the pan-tilt surveillance camera that's been installed in there, that's under software control, that's actually running on a remote server that's sending the signal to the robot itself. And so whether that is in fact an extension of the robot, or whether it's another robot that's in there, because in a way the cameras can become robots on their own, is something I haven't really fully decided on.
Can we talk a little bit about human-animal communication and how that sort of comes up in these kinds of systems, and especially when you're doing something about surveillance? You know, that's a really interesting kind of topic to bring up when it comes to these animals that, like you said, are all around us all the time. I mean, certainly in London, you're basically always on CCTV camera.
Yeah.
And you're probably always a few feet away from a rat. So, what do you, besides the technological implications of this, what goes through your mind when you're thinking about how we communicate with an animal and what the implications of that are?
Yeah. So there is this thing, this strong human desire to commune with animals. And when it comes to pigeons in particular, you know, people go out and they feed them and they have a relationship with them. And of course we have our pets as well, but especially with the wild pigeons and the wild birds that we feed and the other sorts of wild animals that we interact with, that where there's this, again, sort of this Disney princess desire to commune with them in some meaningful way. I think that there's a kind of a false narrative there, you know, in many ways the animals are mostly just in it for the food that we're giving them, and probably there's not as much real communion going on there. Probably a large part because our bodies are not really well suited for being with another animal in a meaningful way. There are exceptions, of course. So in that, I also fall prey to that desire to commune with animals. I kind of see the making of these robots as a way for me to do that in a more successful, potentially, sort of way. And then by extension, people who see my robots can kind of have that experience too and understand more of what it's like to be one of these animals. So, you know, with the lizard robots, for instance, I mean, they're not very big. The lizards that I'm primarily interested in are the Western fence lizards, which are a species of lizard that we have in California. And, you know, they're only maybe 7 inches nose to tail, maybe 4 inches nose to snout. And that's a big one, really. Snout to vent is what I meant with the latter thing, 4 inches snout to vent, snout to cloaca or whatever. You know, when you're around them, I mean, they will sometimes do push-ups for human beings. That's a thing about territorial behaviors, and squirrels will sometimes do tail flicks for human beings. It's a thing that predator species do often to communicate to potential prey species, excuse me, vice versa. Prey species do sometimes to communicate to predator species that I've seen you, because a lot of ambush predators will actually totally respond to that and no longer mess around with that particular individual. So since, you know, humans are potentially squirrel predators too, especially in the United States. In some parts of the United States, there's a lot of good recipes for squirrel pie and squirrel soup and things like that. I don't know. Am I getting very too far away from the original question? I don't know. Okay. You know, when you're near one, it's gonna be thinking of you as a predator. So when I make Danger Squirrel Nutkin, a robot that's much more closely aligned in size and form, well, loosely informed to a squirrel, that robot can have a more conspecific like relationship with the squirrels, and the same sort of thing with the lizards. So that's the thing I'm interested in too, you know, building these bodies that exist in a space that's actually more aligned with the animal's own spaces, and having that allow an investigation of what the animal's lives are like beyond the stories that we tend to tell about them, because we are the storytelling animals. So oftentimes we make up a lot of things that aren't often true. It is true that I have often used territorial signals and alarm signals. Part of that has to do with the degree to which those are heavily salient to the animals. And it's also due to the fact that territory is a big thing for a lot of animals. So I also made a woodpecker robot that has essentially two lives. One of them is as a piece called Nobody Told the Woodpeckers, which is also dealing with territory. It translates the territorial drumming signal of the pileated woodpecker to the black woodpecker and vice versa. And these are two species that are closely related. They're in the same genus, Dryocoppus, but they've never met each other because they've been separated by millions of years, because one is from Eurasia and the other one is from North America. And when I built this back in 2009 and 2010, the idea was that climate change might lead these two birds to come together, and then there'd be a kind of migrant crisis where they wouldn't be able to communicate. So the robot would translate from one to the other and vice versa and solve that. And then in Morse code, it explains anthropogenic climate change, because as the piece is entitled, Nobody Told the Woodpeckers About What We're Up To, which is another thing I've done a few times, is try to explain things like my piece, Little Old Me, from 2004, tries to explain the workings of the internal combustion engine to forest animals like chipmunks and squirrels and deer and things. So
that's so Watership Down to me.
Well, I do love Watership Down, both the book and the movie, which are totally different beasts in a lot of ways, but pretty amazing. I mean, So I wouldn't say that the territory thing is incidental. But I would say that it's not the only thing that I'm interested in. With the lizards, it's also a territorial thing. The truth is that a lot of these territorial signals are also connected to mating. And that's the case with another kind of drumming that the woodpeckers do, that another version of my woodpecker robot, which is called the Woodiest, does. It's essentially a woodpecker sex bot. And then with the lizards, those territorial push-ups are also kind of a mating thing. So there's always been this possibility, I haven't actually seen it, that one of my lizard robots might actually attract a mate, and there might be some attempts at mating, which the robot is fully incapable of dealing with.
Did you say incapable?
Incapable, yeah. Not capable. It does one thing and one thing only. And in a way, that is part of what that piece is about, because lizards have, you know, like all animals, many energetic constraints, many things they need to spend their energy on. They have to find food. They have to declare territories. They have to survive the possible onslaught of predators. They have to actually breed and then have young. And my robot lizardless legs, which is one of the main ones, and also Nary, a yellow-bellied blue belly, which is another one of the lizard ones. They don't have to do anything but hold on to territory. So in many ways, the robot always wins in these confrontations.
You mentioned earlier, I think it was specifically about Squirrel Nutkin, but in much more generally, I think we can say that a lot of these pieces, as sort of visual objects, these builds, they're a bit abstract, aren't they? They don't, you know, like Squirrel Nutkin is just a tail, really.
Three tails
set on.
But yeah,
three tails set onto. And the rest of it looks purely mechanical to our right. eyes. And can you just briefly, you know, describe one or two of these pieces as we would see them, and how that works as a sort of abstraction, and how you think it maybe looks to the animal?
Yeah. So that thing about how it looks to the animal is something that I'm really interested in. Sometimes I talk about animal looking in sort of multi-fold ways. One being what it means to look like an animal, which relates to the shape, the morphology of the objects that I build, and whether they trigger things or not. So what it means to look like an animal, how that might differ from the way human beings think a given animal looks. That's intimately related to how animals themselves look at the world, those that have vision, and then also the practice of observing animals and what they do. So all those are sort of a various kinds of animal looking. So, you know, oftentimes when we create a representation of an animal, it isn't necessarily a good representation of the animal from the animal's own umwelt. The closer the animal is related to us, perhaps it is. So we've definitely been making representations of animals for a long time. And, you know, hunters have made decoys of ducks, which seem to actually work fairly well in convincing the ducks that there are other ducks in a pond and they should come down. So there's an overlap in terms of what is a simulacrum of a duck for the ducks and a simulacrum of a duck for the human beings. But in the case of lizardless legs, for instance, as I said earlier, it doesn't look anything like a lizard. So lizardless legs is almost like a Brancusian kind of stack of diamonds. You know, I'm referencing Endless Column by Brancusi. And so it's just these diamonds that are on top of each other, only a few inches tall. And each of those diamonds can do a push-up. And sometimes they do them in coordination, and sometimes they do them sort of in a syncopated way. There's a lot of different ways in which the robot will respond to seeing a lizard do a push-up. And so, you know, it doesn't look at all like a lizard. But it does with this, again, the sort of the best I can do, recreate the Western fence lizard's push-up. And the lizards definitely seem to get the message when they see it. And so, and the whole thing is triggered by a sensing system of the robot that is also looking for lizard pushups. And in a way that parallels what I was just talking about, vis-a-vis the gesture and the form of the object, the sensing system of the robot doesn't know what a lizard looks like. It only knows what a lizard pushup looks like. So if you do a good version of a lizard pushup with your hand, it will respond quite well. If the lizard isn't moving, it won't acknowledge the lizard at all. So a scientist with whom I was collaborating, mostly in a sort of conversational way at the time, Stephen Adolf, studies Western fence lizards. And he said that they come out of the egg sort of already hyper-tuned to this push-up. Both their sensorium is hyper-tuned to it, and their bodies are kind of already doing it a little bit. So again, sort of to your question of, to what degree do these things actually look like the animals? To us, often not a lot, but what I'm sometimes trying to achieve is that they actually do look like the animals in a way to the animals. And with, you know, Danger Squirrel Nutkin, which you also brought up with the tails, I mean, the tails are there. There's nothing else organic there. There's a very machinic, you know, structure that operates the tails and moves a boom that has the tails on them, all sort of aluminum and other sorts of metals, metallic colors, very kind of Machinic. And that's all on a bed of some fake grass. So if the grass is sort of integrated into the whole thing. And so when you put it on real grass, there's a frame around the grass. It's a square frame. And when I show it in a gallery, I usually put it on real grass. And then over the course of the months that the gallery exhibition is open, the real grass dies and the fake grass stays green, which I think helps a certain understanding of the robot. But the tails being there and doing the tail flick, sometimes I describe it a little bit to the way our sensorium works so well with television or with, you know, your audience probably doesn't know it, but we're on a Zoom call right now and I can see you and you can see me. And it's a raster image. It's a bunch of dots. And because of the way our eyes work and our brains work, that's enough for us to think there's another person there. And importantly, we always frame the image on our faces because that's a big part of how we communicate. You know, our voices are important and it can work alone as it will in this podcast, but I'm actually gesturing this whole time, you know, so I'm using my hands a little bit and I'm also making facial expressions. And that's what happens on television too, with a news report. And we hardly ever wonder about what the person on whose newscasting is doing with their pinky toe, you know? So this is like with Danger Squirrel Nutkin, that part of the animal being there is a little bit like television to me. You know, it's just enough of the animal for that, at least that portion of how the animal communicates to be present and transmitting information to the squirrels.
You know, it is interesting. As you were saying that, I was watching myself in the screen and I've been on mute, but sort of nodding and thumbs up and laughing and all that sort of thing. And it did, I never really thought about the fact that from here down, I could be a robot and we would communicate in exactly the same way. I could be just like a stick of metal.
Or you could be a squirrel.
Maybe I am. Yeah. I could be a squirrel. That would be fantastic.
I definitely call them robots. If I believe they've become a robot, which is a complicated thing. The definition of a robot is as hard as defining art or defining what a tree is. Also a famously hard thing to define. But I do usually feel as if they enter into the domain of being robots, and so I call them such. So yeah, you asked about what Pigeon Smidgen looks like. It's the pigeon pieces, as I was saying before, are pretty strongly related to the rat pieces. And the rat pieces began to explore. I mean, a lot of times I am trying to combine the machinic with the sort of organic or forms that are tied to the nature of animals. There was with the woodiest, which is the woodpecker robot, it was kind of like a mixture of a typewriter with heads that are, and beaks that are kind of like woodpeckers. And with Nevermore-O-Matic, it's a little bit like an oil pump with scythe-like beak heads that are still very much like a crow or a raven's head. But in making a bunch of different pieces related to the rat work, I began to try to amalgamate arm robots and sort of contemporary arm robot forms. And some of the tropes of contemporary robots, there's this black and white thing that's been going on for quite a while. I think, I don't know where it has its origins. I think it might've been that Bjork video with the two kissing robots, but everybody sort of adopted it. And robots are also kind of like dragons. You know, everybody, a given culture, a given time, puts a bunch of ideas about what things are into that thing. And, you know, in the 50s, the robots were metal boxes with rivets and now they've become these smooth-shelled white pieces with black in between. And of course, the term robot is only 100 years old, but the concept, I would argue, is tens of thousands of years old, and maybe intimately connected to our own experience as humans. So I've been taking those black and white shell forms and combining them with forms that are related to the rats. And also somewhat important is that a lot of times my robots just have all the wires hanging out and the printed circuit boards just sitting there, and you know, I just got it out. And if it rains, it actually is usually fine, surprisingly. I did a lot of stuff with saltwater robots for a long time, and I was surprised when I first made a robot that was in freshwater, how well it survived. I made one called On Beyond Duckling that had a PCB that was just totally out, and it was rowing to the middle of the pond and doing mating dances for a mate I never built. And it flipped over, and I thought that was the end of it, and picked it out of the water and shook it off, and it was totally fine. But the reason I bring up this tendency to kind of have the wires out is that when I was making these robots for rats, that was totally not going to happen. Rats are very interested in exploring things with their incisors and nibbling through. So for not exactly the first time, but with a vengeance, I had to kind of begin to armor my robots. So these new robots that come out of that space do have shells, and these black and white shells. And I made a piece that was related to the idea of the entanglement that rats have in our built environment called the Rat King. There was a bunch of these kind of articulated arms that are made out of black and white shell plastic with sort of noses that are kind of like rat noses that were in places like the crawl space in an office, well, my office, or in the basement corner, or under the sink. And Pigeon Smidgen is inherited from that. I could talk about what Pigeon Smidgen was in 2017. It's always had the testicles, which are plastic toy-like testicles that I modeled up off of pictures that I could find on the internet of pigeon testicles. Actually, my neuroscientist collaborator who studies rats ended up with a dead pigeon at one point, and I was able to look a little bit at the real testicles. But that's always been part of Pigeon Smidgen, but now it's kind of inherited the black and white arms that are associated with the Whisker and Rat King and Rat re-embodied as a robot. So if you were to look at it, you'd see a piece of a fixture for mounting a surveillance camera on a wall. You'd see, which is also black and white, and then this black and white series of right angle pieces that each are actuated, each has a motor in them that comes after a few different angles, comes to a little flesh-colored support that holds onto bright purple, sort of royal purple, plastic toy-like testicles. So hopefully that gives you an idea.
And what is it during these 2 weeks that you've been at the zoo? What have you been, well, can you just tell us a little bit about that experience more generally, but also what have you seen, what have you learned, what has the robot learned from your and its encounters with the Victoria Crown pigeons? And I assume hundreds, if not thousands, of daily sort of normal everyday pigeons and human beings. Well, I mean, for that matter, I don't know to what extent this is something that is open, that the public experiences or sees or touches or has any communication with.
Yeah, I mean, the public absolutely has access. That's a big part of the idea of these machine wilderness residencies and artists is to have artists be able to be with the animals, but also the public that's visiting artists have the experience of seeing these things happening. And it's great for the kinds of projects I do, because there's always been a little bit of a dialogical aspect to what I do, bringing these things out, having them be there. You know, at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, especially when I was making these robots, there was a constant sort of refrain of, oh, you should be making robots for the military. And in a lot of ways, that's part of what I was trying to move away from. If we succeed in making robots, what we really mean by robots, which is sort of artificially intelligent, incorporeal kind of artificially built things, then it'll be the first time we've made something that can actually reflect on the nature of its own origins. And there's a certain, I think, obligation to provide an origin story that's something that those future robots can feel good about. Otherwise, we might end up encapsulating some of our own worst aspects. And that's kind of how it felt. And, you know, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, it kind of felt as if robots were going to be war machines, and that's exactly what they're going to be and no more. And so making this effort to give them a different kind of genesis, a different origin story that's more rooted in play and a love for the natural environment and an interest in the environment was part of what I was and am trying to achieve. So those conversations then, when people said, you know, you should be working for the military, were exactly the kinds of things I wanted to talk about then with those folks and see what they thought about the idea that robots could be for something else. And I think in the intervening years, I mean, it's been a couple decades, I think my work and other people who worked in this sort of domain have maybe succeeded a little bit, because I think the conversation about what robots are for and can be has very much expanded. But still, an artist, it's an opportunity to continue that conversation with the public about what we're doing, why I'm building this robot for pigeons, how it relates to robots in general and our relationship with technology and our technology's relationship with the environment and animals. So yes, the robot and I have spent a lot of time wandering around the park, and some of my other robots. I brought a few other robots. I brought Nevermore-O-Matic, and I brought Ziggy Dirt Dust and its cousin On Beyond Lowly Worm. And I brought Elongate Evans, and I brought Rat Re-Embodied as a robot. And part of the reason it was easy to bring a lot of these robots is some of them are all made of parts of other ones, because a lot of the rat and pigeon robots are kind of modular in a way. And I've been experimenting with this idea. So I don't know if this is a commonly known thing, but in robotics, there's this idea of the end effector. So yeah. So when you see, I mean, obviously people, you see ABB arm robots and KUKA arm robots and television advertisements for cars and things like orange robots that are assembling cars or putting a windshield on or painting the car. And the base robot is an arm robot. And then when they're doing the automation process to build out that whatever is happening in that factory, they'll put different end effectors on the tip of the robot. One that could be for welding, or one that could be for painting, or one that could have suction cups so it can lift the windshield. So I've been experimenting a little bit with these robots with having different end effectors that sort of change the whole nature of the robot. One of the end effectors is the pigeon smidgen testicles. One is a nose that has whiskers on it, and one is a nose that has nothing on it. So when I say I brought a rat re-embodied as a robot, and I brought pigeon smidgen, I actually brought a robot that's 90% of both of those, and then different end effectors, and then different core behaviors. You know, their underlying programming is very different, but in body they share quite a lot.
And so what has been the experience for you and your machines in the past 2 weeks? What have they learned? What have you learned? Has it changed things?
Yeah. So I guess for one, in this era of machine learning, and I do use machine learning a lot in my robots and have done for a long time, actually, before the deep learning revolution, you know, I had a robot in the Pittsburgh Science Center that was pretending to explore, well, in its mind, thinking that it was exploring the lunar surface, and it had a machine learning algorithm that was actually interpreting the fish and people who were visiting the museum as the extraterrestrial beings that it had discovered. And that was in 2008 and 2009, I think. And that was using not deep neural networks, but old school stuff like support vector machines, which are still very useful. But part of the reason I mentioned that is that with some of the more recent work, I've actually been exposing the machine learning aspect more, or at least the vision system more, with Fine Feathered Friends, which was a sort of performance of the Cinderella robot. The outcome is actually these, again, episodic memories that the robot had of times when it saw the animals that it was interested in. So Cinderella has these romantic or romanticized relationships with birds and so on. But Cinderella, the robot, which is just made of a cinder block, it's just kind of the minimum amount of building to support a surveillance camera, is having sort of similar things with the urban animals, you know, rats and pigeons and also ducks and geese. And so I reveal those experiences more by showing the actual view that the robot has. But this is all to say that in the park, in artists for these past 2 weeks, I actually haven't been having any of the robots do anything close to active learning. They're not learning, and I'm not running any trainings of any machine learning algorithms. So the degree to which any learning is happening, it's mostly me seeing what's happening with the robots and the animals and taking note of that and doing the usual thing that I do, which is sort of iterating on the robots in response to what happens with the animals. In this case, not iterating as much on the form or the sculptural mechanical aspects of the robots, because that's a little fixed for this time period, but iterating through different sorts of gestures and responses and places that might be interesting to the robots to be. I've been right at the beginning. I took one of my worm robots around, and I thought it was, for a worm robot, you know, there's always a sort of Pinocchio aspect to these robots. They're aspiring to actually be the real thing. And for a robot that's aspiring to be a worm, having a relationship with a very large bird like an ostrich seemed as if it might be a big deal. So I took that robot out, Ziggy Dirt Dust, and had it do some performances for the ostriches, which seemed pretty interested. I actually do not know if ostriches are omnivores and would actually eat a worm. I have to look that up. But I also brought it to the Victoria Crown pigeons and things like that. So there's been a lot of just seeing what the animals think.
What about you? What do you feel like? What are you taking back from this in terms of the machines and the animals, but also in terms of the way the public interacts with them? I mean, have you had experiences that have given you new ideas or make you look at something differently?
Well, you know, I can think of one. There are probably many examples, but the one that jumps to mind first is, as a preamble, I'll say that I don't make humanoid robots, which should be pretty evident at this point. There's a lot of effort to make humanoid robots. So I don't need to be participating in that. And so also when I've made sex bots, it's been an opportunity to make sex bots for animals that have never had sex bots made for them. Because we've made a lot of sex bots and imagined a lot of sex bots for humans. But, you know, it being just, well, it's hard to say. You know, there was a long portion in COVID when the artist was closed. And I guess there was the idea that maybe the animals were going to be excited about there being fewer people around, giving them a hard time. But from what I understand with talking with people at artists, there was actually for many of the animals a reverse thing, where the absence of the animals was a problem of sorts, because they were used to having the humans as a kind of engaging thing for them to look at. So there was a thing that came up, I think it was just yesterday, where it could even make sense for me to make humanoid robots that are not intended for humans, but are intended for the animals, so that they can have replacement humans when the humans are gone for some reason, maybe even when we're really gone, just so they can remember us.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. Until then, sign up for the free Uncanny Landscapes newsletter at uncannylandscapes.substack.com or follow us on Twitter at @unlandscapes. My guest was artist Ian Ingram. His website is linked in the podcast info, ianingram.org. The music is When the Sun Came by guitarist Nick Jonah Davis. Find him on Bandcamp or check the links. The title theme is by the Balbury Poly. The Uncanny Landscapes icon is by Stefan Musgrove. I'm Justin Hopper. You can contact me via Twitter at @unlandscapes or the Substack mentioned before. Previous episodes of this podcast and lots of links and all that good stuff are available at uncannylandscapes.podbean.com. Remember to tell a friend about this podcast and newsletter. And until next time, I leave you with a 60-second snapshot of the Uncanny Vale, a bright, windy spring morning at Flatford Mill in Suffolk, the site of John Constable's iconic landscape painting, The Hay Wave.